The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information.
And now, the bottom line. Thanks to IT Financial Services. High quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Yes, and a very good morning to both Carly Tonkinson and Philip Tafe from IT Financial Services. Both of you, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Nice to be back. Nice to see you again, although the world of finance continued on in my absence,
never
of course.
Stops.
Never stops. And today, well, yesterday now, was a shocker on the share market, wasn't it?
Very stormy day, off the back of people worrying about whether the US is going to put up interest rates sooner than they expected. And that caused, I think, the US market and ours to fall about 2%.
Yeah, it was Brexit a couple of months ago, and now it's the likelihood of the US Federal Reserve raising interest rates. That's it, isn't it? I mean, why would that concern the stock market?
With the stock market, people look to interest rates and what central banks are doing with interest rates as an indication of the economy. But when we see things that are unexpected, the stock market will always have quite a big reaction, and that's what we've seen. So initially, and certainly a couple of weeks ago, we saw the markets performing quite well, and that was on the back of people expecting that they may take a bit longer to raise rates, and it may not be until next year. But after the latest Fed meeting, they've come out and it looks like their language is indicating that they will potentially start raising those rates sooner than later. Again, the market doesn't expect it, so it's going to react pretty violently towards that, and that's what we saw today.
The share market likes low interest rates because it means money's cheap to borrow. You know, companies can get access to funds more easily.
Mm.
It also makes shares more popular because you're not going to go, well, you're less likely to put your money in a bank account and earn very little. You're more likely to go look to buy shares, which might give you a higher dividend. But the irony is that when interest rates are falling, it's normally a sign that things are bad economically. So now that rates are going back up, it's some kind of sign that there's a strengthening economy in the US, and yet that then causes share markets to fall. So it's all counterintuitive. If you're trying to invest day to day, it really is speculation and almost gambling. Whereas if you take a longer term view, it probably doesn't have that much of an impact.
It's interesting you mentioned the sort of the political spin on this, because even in Australia we've seen all this take place where governments have watched interest rates go down and down and claimed it often as a good news story and something that they've achieved. Yet, as you say, with rates at record lows, it's not correlating with a record healthy economy.
It's political spin.
It's a desperate stimulation, isn't it?
And you do. I mean, both sides do it all the time. I'll look at the high interest rates under this government. Oh, you know, we've kept rates at record lows. And, yeah, the truth is it's mainly driven by the economy. The rates are set by the central banks, and that's monetary policy, and interest rates are the main tool for that.
Mm.
It is largely about the economy, not about whatever government may be in power. I guess, look, the governments that are in power certainly have an influence on the economy. The RBA, for example, has been saying for some time that the government really need to step in with fiscal policy, so that's the budget. They need to step in and start doing things with that, because monetary policy alone is not cutting it at the moment.
Yep. Okay, 131873 is the open line number. If you've got any questions for either Carly or Philip, give us a call, 131873. They're here to answer your questions on, well, just about anything to do with personal finance, isn't it? From super through to property,
investment shares,
yep. All of that. 131873. A lot of people listening are retirees or pensioners, and of course they've heard since the budget last year, this year rather, they've heard a lot of talk about retirees set to lose the age pension from January the 1st next year. A lot of confusion still around that. Firstly, do you want to maybe explain that? And secondly, it may not be the case that everyone's worse off, right?
So I guess to let people know what's happening, so from the 1st of January, there's changes coming in. What they're doing, it sounds complicated, but they're going to change what they call the taper rate. So currently, for every $1,000 of assets you have above a certain threshold, you lose $1.50 worth of age pension until the result is that you don't get any. They're going to increase that to $3, so people will lose the age pension a lot quicker. So come 1 January, about 300,000 people are going to be worse off or lose the age pension. So it's a big change. I think increasingly leading up to 1 January, we're going to see a lot in the media about it, so people are going to start to worry. And definitely people do need to be planning ahead. But also lost in some of this as well is that some people are going to be better off. So we're going to see a lot more people on the full age pension. So some people will be able to potentially draw down less from their own assets, for example, and that will be replaced with an increase in age pension. But the message is plan ahead. A lot of people are going to have to start drawing income from somewhere else, from lost benefits. And it's not just the fortnightly amount that you may be getting. It's also things like your free car rego and your discounted telephone bills, etc.
Mm. And to put a number on that for the people that are likely to be better off, if you are a married couple and you own your own home, if you have less than about $450,000 in assets in addition to your own home, you'll be better off under the new system. But conversely, anyone with more than $450,000 will be worse off. And for people who are single, who own their own home, the threshold's around $290,000-odd. So if you've got less than that, you're better off. More than that, you'll be worse off under the new rules.
There seems to be an element of the talking about superannuation and pensions broadly out of the budget. There seems to be this idea, well, I don't know if it's an idea or what, but it to me, it's the definition of what superannuation is actually designed to do and what it's about needs to be more tightly framed and applied in government policy. There doesn't seem to be a clear definition out of Canberra about what they want super to do, what it's there to actually achieve, whether it's there to be a savings pool where you can spend some of it and then hand the rest down as a gift really to the next generation,
or
whether the idea is that you've got to spend the lot. I mean,
they want you to spend it, and we see that they have minimum drawdowns, for example, and those minimums increase the older you get. They don't want this pool of money left, you know, tax-free, then handed over to your beneficiaries in your estate. We're also seeing, so policies such as the $1.6 million cap, the basis for that is, look, we think that is enough to generate a reasonable income for retirement, so you can have that saved in this really tax-effective environment. If you've got more than that, sure, you can still save it. It can still be quite tax effective, but it's not going to be as good. And that's just all on the basis. They do not want people saving this huge money, you know, in super to leave to their kids, basically. And I mean, it is a conflict. A lot of clients will say to me, you know, it's not fair. Why do they force me to draw it? I don't need to spend it. But the fact of the matter is, in that tax effective environment, it should just be for you and your retirement. There's nothing stopping you from investing that money elsewhere. If you're being forced to take out more than what you need, invest it elsewhere by all means, but it just won't be tax-free anymore.
And there are rules already around, you know, when you do pass away, obviously to spouses or if you have young children, your superannuation can be inherited tax-free. But any adult children or people who aren't dependent upon you, they do pay a lump of tax on a portion of your super. So the rules are already designed to try and prevent you from using it simply as a mechanism to pass money on to the next generation in a tax-free manner.
And as far as handing that money down after you've passed on, a lot of people I've heard say, oh, you should tightly define in your will who will receive your superannuation, but it's not always legally sound, is it, that?
No, well, superannuation is not actually an estate asset, so that means that the will technically doesn't cover superannuation. It would only be if the superannuation is paid to your estate that then the will would come in. And I think, look, superannuation can be a really good tool for complicated estates because you can actually, in most cases, put a binding nomination in. And what that means is that regardless of what else happens, if that binding nomination is valid, it will go to that person that you've made that nomination to. So if you're expecting a complicated estate or something that may be contested, by doing that you can add a bit of certainty to what will happen after you pass away. Double-edged sword, though, you need to make sure that binding nomination's up to date. So say you make a binding nomination to a spouse, divorce, remarry, don't update nominations, former spouses can still potentially be considered a beneficiary. So the other thing with super that we see quite commonly is people nominating parents or siblings as beneficiaries of their super funds. Parents and siblings are not considered to be an eligible beneficiary of super, so in those cases the money would generally go to the estate and be paid out that way. So worthwhile, like particularly when you're young, you start a fund, you know, you nominate your mum and dad, and that seems like the logical thing to do.
Yeah, you're not married, all
bit
that.
Of thanks. Yeah. but those nominations are generally not valid, and would go to your estate. So just be a bit careful about what you may have nominated years ago would not be current.
I do often wonder because I see statements from clients like that, and a lot of industry super funds, and it clearly says on the form,
father, mother,
nominated my sister 100%, which a super fund should know that that is not legally, you know, entitled to be the case, and yet they list it on the form. So don't rely on your statement thinking that that is correct. You know, you need to really get some advice, or, and you can do that very simply probably by calling the super fund and asking them for some very simple advice on, you know, the correct nomination. Or if you want more detailed advice, you're going to need to talk to a financial advisor or even a solicitor.
Solicitor, yeah. All right, 131873 is the open line number. Any questions concerning your own personal finances, take advantage of the free advice on offer in the next 40 minutes, 131873. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more in just a sec. Morning on the first hour, we talk finance with the team from IT Financial Services. Your calls are welcome. 131873 is the number. Colin's called. Hi, Colin. You've got Carly and Philip there.
G'day, Michael, Carly and Philip. My question is that my parents-in-law have got their own home and car and a caravan with just under $500,000 in the bank. Does that mean as of 1st of January they'll lose their pension cards or any of those benefits?
No, they may see a reduced rate of pension. So as Philip mentioned earlier, if you're a couple homeowner and you've got assessable assets over the 450 mark,
yeah,
you would expect to see a drop in your pension.
Again, the figure is roughly, if you did have exactly the $500,000 and your own home, it would drop from about $27,000 a year down to $25,000 a year.
Oh, that's good to know that it doesn't drop out totally.
No, and they'd obviously keep the card and all those benefits.
Oh, that's good, Carly. Thank you for that.
Thanks a lot, Colin.
Thank you.
Thanks, Colin. 131873. On the topic of binding nominations, Ken's just sent us an email saying, why does a binding nomination only last for a relatively short time? Why can't it stay in place until death or you change the nomination?
Yeah,
it can.
It did actually used to be a 3-year period, and some funds might still be running those. And that was when they were first introduced. So prior, look, I think maybe about 10 years ago they introduced binding nominations. Prior to that, it was just up to trustee discretion. They introduced binding nominations, but they lapsed every 3 years. The reasoning behind that was to, because they are so powerful, because it is binding regardless of what else may have happened, they wanted to make sure people were regularly updating them. But they did introduce the what are now called non-lapsing binding nominations, which, look, I saw that as a really good thing. You still have to be very careful to make sure it's updated, but issues were raised as things like if you lose mental capacity, for example, and you can't physically make a new binding nomination, you'd be disadvantaged under that 3-year rule.
It's also a very good reason for people to shop around super funds because, you know, you get what you pay for. Cheap, cheerful fund and hasn't bothered to update its trust deed in the last 10 years to offer a non-lapsing binding nomination, which is, you know, a pretty basic function, whereas most good funds would have updated their trustees to allow that many, many years ago. So I would say shop around.
Okay, 131873. Hi, John.
Oh, good morning. Just got a question about, double barrel, really. One is defined benefits as against what we've now got. Now, defined benefits just disappeared. That's my first question.
Defined benefit super funds, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, could you enter anywhere a defined benefit super fund, or is that just not available anywhere to anybody?
No, some still exist, but it generally is offered by an employer, and they're not offered that much anymore because they're expensive to run, they're hard to guarantee, you know, a level of funds, and employers, by and large, are shifting towards this accumulation option where you invest it yourself and you go for the ride with whatever you choose to invest in. The way that people, I guess, try and create that defined benefit these days is that they take their money that's in super or leave it in super, but maybe purchase some kind of lifetime annuity or some kind of product like that that gives you a guaranteed payment for a period of time or for your life. So you're effectively creating that defined benefit yourself.
Oh, that's an interesting angle. Can I just take the question to another area now, where wills as against family trust. Can you set up a family trust so that only a certain amount of your will kind of goes in to being a will,
mm-hmm,
and the rest of it, I don't really understand if family trusts have any kind of mileage in them.
Well, I think it'd probably actually be a testamentary trust that you're referring to. So
I didn't realise that terminology.
Yeah, so what happens is in your will, you might say, let's say, I mean, it's quite common, for example, in my will, for my kids, I've three young kids. So if something happened to my wife and I, I wouldn't want my kids just to inherit a large lump of money. So the will establishes what's called a testamentary trust. The assets and the funds would go in there, and then I've nominated people that I trust to then manage that testamentary trust for the benefit of my kids as the beneficiaries until they reach a certain age and are old enough to take over the control of that themselves. And that has a whole lot of other benefits. It has tax benefits, and it also has, I guess, asset protection benefits. You know, if my kids reached 18 and moved in with their first girlfriend and then broke up, it kind of protects the asset somewhat, you know, from, I guess, normal divorce rules and things like that.
De facto laws and things. Mm.
Could a testamentary trust, now to have used that expression, go into a long-term future, say, for any other members of the family that are still benefiting?
Yeah, they can. So you can, they can establish what's called like a bloodline trust, for example, within that testamentary trust. So in those cases, the terms of the trust would dictate what happens to the funds. So you might have a term where the capital is invested and the beneficiaries receive the income, but the capital remains invested for the benefit of all future bloodline. So, you know, direct family members of beneficiaries. Look, the only way a testamentary trust can be established is through a will. And as Philip said, the asset protection, but the taxation as well is very effective. A lot of people will use something like that for a vulnerable trustee as well. So for people that may have drug dependency or something similar. So it can be a good way to protect assets well into the future. I think, look, one of the most famous testamentary trusts we see is the Reinhardt case, where her children were set to inherit at a certain age, and those terms of the trust were changed after the death of Lang. So, they can be pretty complicated, but they're very powerful tools when they're used correctly.
Can we come to your trust, ITS, for, I'm seeing a combination of a will and testamentary trust, or do you go to a lawyer first, or to some people like yourself who are financial advisors, or is it a combination of those two?
A combination, and that's generally going to give you the best result. Certainly you would need a lawyer to be establishing the structure for you, so that testamentary trust is actually included in your will, and it's worthwhile paying a good lawyer to set those sort of things up for you to make sure it's as airtight as it possibly can be. But financial advisors would, most financial advisors would be able to give you some guidance on what sort of questions you need to ask the solicitor on what sort of assets should be going into the trust. So, should your family home go in there, or should, your superannuation be directed there? So there's all different decisions that need to be made. So I'd certainly say a combination of advice will work best for you.
And that's possibly where we can save you some time and money too, because we can have that discussion around, who's appropriate to be the trustee of the trust and things like that, and, kick that concept around rather than doing that in front of a solicitor where you might be racking up a fairly hefty hourly bill.
All right, John, thank you for the call. Interesting line of questions there. 131873, if you've got a question you want to put to Carly or Philip. Emails coming in as well, guys, from listeners. Darren wants to know, what do both of you think of owning physical precious metals in your super? As Darren says, mainly to preserve wealth over time, to outpace or at least keep up with inflation and protect against the next crash around the corner. Precious metals in your super fund, gold and silver,
gold,
bullion,
yeah.
I guess.
I think storage would be the most difficult issue.
Security.
And there are other ways of achieving it, I think, rather than holding the physical, for example, gold. You can trade exchange-traded funds that basically their price mimics the gold price, and you can buy and sell those as cheaply as, $20 or $30 a trade, just like you would buy or sell any share. And so, we've used that in clients' portfolios in times of uncertainty for some protection. But my general feeling with things like gold is that it's so speculative. It generates no income. If you've got a long investment time horizon in front of you, it's not really going to offer you this growth potential. It's more just a bet against the world going very, very bad. And I tend to be a little more optimistic than that.
Yeah, and I think, if you're looking at buying physical gold and holding it, you are probably looking at a long-term investment horizon anyway. So if you're taking that long-term investment horizon, there's probably other assets that you can generate more growth and income out over that time.
Such as?
Well, equities, so you're going to get growth on those over the years. You've also got really good dividend stream on a lot of them, whereas Philip says you're not getting income from that gold. Definitely not getting it from it sitting, you know, in the safe at home. And I think, I mean, look, to hold a lot of gold, you've got to transport it here. There's going to be a lot of costs involved in actually acquiring the asset. You can't go down the street and just pick some up. I'm not even sure in Australia where now sells physical gold. Is it Western Australia? Is one of the only places. So you've got that issue, but you've also got, as I said, the security. I mean, you've got to keep it somewhere. There's going to be costs associated with that and additional risk as well.
Yeah. I would have thought those costs went... sorry, I can't recall
Darren. The email, yes.
Darren was saying, why don't you invest in this just to keep pace with inflation? I would have thought the costs would at least
erode
that kind of value.
Good. 131873. More after this. It's about to go 25 minutes to one. The morning is already flying by. It's just come through from the UK, by the way, that David Cameron, the now former Prime Minister of Great Britain, will stand down as an MP. So he'll leave Parliament. That'll trigger a by-election, I'd imagine, in the UK, although you'd think he's in a pretty safe Conservative seat, so it wouldn't be too much trouble there. We'll keep an eye on that this morning. 131873. We're talking finance in this first hour with Carly Tonkinson and Philip Tafe from IT Financial Services. A range of questions coming in this morning. Michael's got one. Hi, Michael.
Oh, good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I've got a four-member fund, and my concern is the other members show no sign of interest in operating the fund, even though I've explained to them incessantly that they're legally liable for all my decisions because they're all trustees. And I've deliberately not put in a binding death nomination or a reversionary pension and hopefully leave it all in the hands of the surviving trustees when I cark it, because I'm the oldest one. Mm. But they don't know anything.
And Michael, do you have them as a member for a reason?
I'm sorry?
Do you have them as members for a reason? Do they need to be in the fund? Are they, you know, do you require their funds to...
Well, you know, there's the advantage. This is a fund that's been going for 30 years, you know, that was set up by my parents. You know, it was actually set up in 1964. You know, so there's quite a large balance in it now, but that's only the effect of time and compounding. But my main concern is they're just not interested. They trust me completely.
And look, it does make a good point because we do constantly remind people in self-managed superannuation funds that they, I mean, as you say, they're trustees, they have a legal responsibility.
Exactly, I explain that to them, you know.
And if people are not willing to take on that legal responsibility, then they need to ask themselves whether or not they should be in that self-managed super fund structure in the first place. And also worth noting, keep in mind that adult children inheriting super fund assets need to take the money out of superannuation. So your children couldn't inherit funds from you and elect to keep it in that superannuation environment. So potentially...
Well, you're talking about adult children.
Yeah, so yeah, potentially...
Oh, well, I've still got minor children, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Even though I'm nearly 70, my children are still... I started a bit late.
So your kids are minor children and members of the fund?
I'm sorry?
Is it your adult children that are members of the fund or minor children?
I've still got all my children in full-time. The rule is any child 25 or under in full-time study.
Okay.
I'm still in that position, but it'll only be for another couple of more years.
Yeah.
But I'll still have my spouse, and she's not the slightest bit interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't keep any secrets, but, you know, I keep trying to keep them informed, but if they show no interest...
Yeah, and I guess all you can do is keep trying, but I think definitely it's worth keep trying. You know, when we see clients who have, inherited assets, particularly if they've inherited them quite suddenly and they haven't been involved in the running of funds and they don't even know what might be invested, it's a very difficult transition for people to suddenly have to start taking on that responsibility.
But also a lot of people with self-managed funds don't actually truly self-manage their super fund. They get advice, they go talk to somebody else, they then take that on board and make a decision. So I probably think that's the way you need to go. You need to get spouse, kids in front of some trusted advisor of some form so that into the future, if you're not around to make those decisions, they've got someone that they can still rely on and say, well, what do you think? and then they sign off on it as a trustee.
It's not also just, is it about, say, Michael eventually, like all of us, passing away and handing this sort of responsibility down? I mean, heaven forbid someone like he who basically runs it becomes incapacitated mentally, you know, 50 or 60, 70, 80 years old, and all the others relying on it have no idea what's going on. You're left with this big knowledge gap until you find trusted advice.
And I see that a lot. People coming to us who've managed their self-managed fund all through retirement, and then they hit, you know, 75 or 80 years of age, and they come to us and say, look, I just don't want to do it anymore. I'm not as sharp.
Not up to it. Yep.
And I don't want to sit there worrying about it every day, so help me.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Michael. 131873. Just further to that before we go back to calls, I was asking you off air, what, you know, self-managed super funds for some are sort of seen as trendy, I suppose, if nothing else. But if you've got a big family, the rule, is it not, is you can have a maximum of four persons in a self-managed super fund. So say you've got three children, husband and wife, and there's five, what do you do?
You'd leave the eternal student out of it because they're unlikely to have any super. I mean, you're right. You would have to look at splitting those funds. So if you both decided that you wanted, you know, the whole family wants a self-managed super fund structure, you'd potentially have to, I guess, have fund one and fund two, maybe put the kids in one and the parents in the other.
Or is that a case for a family trust?
Well, no, because the super fund would have assets in a different structure altogether. They're completely separate entities. I think, look, the advantages of having the combined family members in the fund is that you could all invest in, say, large assets together, you know, for the benefit of the whole fund. But the problem is, particularly with parents and children, is that both of those sets of people have completely different investment objectives and want completely different things out of their fund. So often one set of people will find that their objectives are actually not being met. So people really need to make sure they stay on top of these, particularly these intergenerational funds, because it needs to do the best by all members.
And if all the assets of the fund aren't in just one large asset like you're talking about, then there's really no economy of scale that you're getting by having everyone in the one fund. You know, split it up, let the younger person put it in a separate fund and put it in shares and go high growth, and the older people have it in another fund and do a completely different investment strategy.
Okay, 131873 is the number. Kevin, hi.
Hello there. Simple question. My wife and I are both age pensioners, and we got no family to be power of attorney. And the people that's doing it for us, can I mention who they are?
Well, it's probably best not to, Kevin.
Right. Okay, fine. We don't want to lose control of the estate. They said they'll take the estate and they'll look after it for us. How do I stand with that?
You need to be, I guess, a little bit careful. I mean, you obviously need a will when you've got still each other so that you can leave each other the assets. And it's not always just about, you know, would you be entitled to the assets? And it sounds, you know, in your case, you certainly would be entitled to each other's. It's just the administration of the estate itself. So if you don't have that will in place, it can be very expensive to administer the will, not to mention quite a lot of work.
It's just stressful at that time too.
Exactly.
Transferring registration of a car or something, you know.
None of those fancy stuff. I just, poor old pensioners, age pensioners, we've got no assets, no nothing.
You've got your own home?
Nope.
No, okay.
No, nothing.
Yeah, so look, if you've got one way to, I guess, limit the issue there would be to make sure that any bank accounts you're holding are in joint names.
Yep.
So that would automatically go to the other person. So, look, potentially in that case you don't have an estate because if all your assets are joint, they would automatically revert to your spouse. But then it's what happens then when the surviving spouse was to pass away. And look, on that I guess you could take the attitude that you don't really care what would happen in that situation because you've got no beneficiaries. You must have nominated someone to, you know, to receive the funds in the event of your death?
Yeah, my wife and I just each one take over, like, you know. If I go, she gets it. She goes, I get it.
And after that, once you both pass away?
Well, we've got in place to put some money at the charities.
Yeah, okay. So you'd still want a will to make sure that that's specified. And look, the only other word of warning I guess I would give you is that some of these places that take on these administration roles can be extremely expensive. So just make sure that you shop around there. I think the real issue for yourself, Kevin, is the power of attorney issue more than the will. Yeah. So you mentioned that you don't have anybody you could make as power of attorney. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably worth another conversation with a solicitor just for what other ideas you might have there, because we have seen case after case of situations where, you know, if you become incapacitated, the difficulty in just getting things done for the remaining spouse can be quite harrowing. Mm-hmm. So, look, I think a power of attorney is probably more relevant for you at this point.
Now, the people who do is going to do the thing for me, this mm. more. I don't want to have the complete control. I want to wrap it up into a parcel, do the estate and be POA at the same time.
And, Kevin, if you're saying that you don't actually have any assets, though, I mean...
Oh, I've got money assets.
Right, okay. So that is an asset. Mm, so
okay.
From that point of view, yeah, you need a will. I don't think it needs to be complicated, but it might be worth thinking about who you trust to act as an executor in the event of something happening to either you or your wife, to be able to step in and, I guess, fulfill your wishes. That would be the best alternative, particularly to cut down on costs, than outsourcing it to, a law firm or some third party.
So that's what I thought about, yeah. Okay, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
All right, Kevin, thank you for taking the time to call. 131873, if you've got a question, it's just about to go 12:45. It's 12:01. Nice to have you there with us on this Tuesday morning, the 13th of September, 2016. 131873 is the open line number. Kathy's waiting in Brisbane. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, hi. I'm in a bit of a dilemma. I fluctuate between Brisbane and Sydney, and my dad died recently, and he left me his home in Sydney.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I'm half owner of my house in Brisbane here.
Mm.
And what do I need to do to leave the house in Sydney to my two kids? I don't want my husband to be involved in it because he has mental health issues and alcohol problems.
Kathy, the best thing I think I can tell you is that you need to speak to a solicitor, and I'll just clarify, we're not solicitors, so even though we know quite a lot about estate planning, any of these sort of legal questions really need to be discussed with a solicitor. But look, my understanding and from previous experience, certainly you would need to be leaving it in the will. It is an estate asset. I understand that additional letters of explanation as to why you've made certain decisions can assist if you think your husband would contest the will. And your solicitor may also discuss with you making sure that you've adequately, provided or can be seen to have provided for him in your estate as well. So a solicitor really is, I think, the only person who can properly answer that question for you.
Yes, well, look, I tell you what, my husband would not be capable of contesting the will. So
it should be quite straightforward. Because your will can specify specific assets to go to certain people, or it could be more general and say, I want half my estate to go to one child and half to the other. But if you specifically want that property to go to, your children, you can absolutely put that in the will. And the executors should carry out those wishes.
Yeah, is there something I can download online, like a will kit?
You can get will kits from the post office, but again, and look, it depends on what your other assets are, Kathy, and what your intentions are with your husband as well. Because even though yes, you can say I want to leave house at whatever street to my children, I think you do need to just consider that issue of the possible the possibility it would be contested. And even though your husband may not be himself capable, a lawyer would be more than happy to lead him through that for many, many hours. So I do think it is important to address the issue with a lawyer. But look, the will kits from the post office, I guess they're better than nothing. But my advice would be, and it does sound like you are concerned about it, my advice would be to spend the money on a solicitor and get your will put together properly.
Kathy, thank you for that. I hope that does help. 131873 is our open line number if you have a question. Patricia does. Hi, Patricia.
Hello there. Look, thank you. I'm 81 years of age, and I've had some managed funds invested, and they've been closing it down. I have the letter saying they're closing it down in October 2011, and I have been receiving this money quarterly, but now, and they said they would finalise it in 2014. When I'm asking for the last little amount, $3,699, they keep telling me they can't give me that last little bit left because of other investors.
Yeah, it sounds typical of these funds that froze up during the GFC.
Yes.
And so, they basically invested in things that can't be sold easily. It may have been a property or a bond somewhere around the world.
So it's just that I'm 81 and I want to wind up my will. And I've rang them, as I said. They definitely told me 2014. They keep putting this last little bit of money off. Mm. Is there anything I can do?
Sometimes they have provisions, you know, in the case of financial hardship, the companies have a bit of a, I guess, a war chest of funds to be able to release to people in those situations. But you'd have to be able to demonstrate that you, you know, need access to those funds urgently. If it's just for your will, though, and you're still alive.
That's what I did. Like, I've got, it's only a small, I mean, it's the amount, it's only $60,000 all I've got. I'm a pensioner, but I want to wind it up for my children when I'm making the will.
Well, it just means that, you know, if something happened to you, your kids would inherit that, and they would just wait for it to wind up, and then they would receive the cash proceeds. So I don't think they'll miss out on anything by inheriting it via your will.
No. So just leave it. There's nothing I can do, really.
Not really, unless you want to inquire of the company, is there some other, I guess, loophole due to, you know, financial hardship or...
No. I mean, I'm just, you know, it was just me just sort of getting a bit nitty
about it. Oh, it's amazing that it's dragged on for this long with some of these investments.
Yeah,
I mean,
just that it was so long, I just thought, right. Okay, look, thank you for that.
No problems. Thanks, Patricia.
Good on you, Patricia. Thanks for calling. That's what it's about. Now, we are quickly running out of time here this morning, but generally speaking, we've had a few people over the months talk about real estate and ask about real estate. But regarding investing in real estate, if people think it's a property bubble or not, I suppose that depends who you ask, doesn't it, at the moment?
Yeah, and I think we are seeing a lot of questions about that. The thing is with property is that you must be viewing it as a long-term investment anyway, even more so than shares, because it's such a big cost to get into it and such a big cost to get out of it. It's not, you know, you can't just sell it in one day. It takes a while to sell, particularly in non-city areas. It can take months and months to sell a property. Mm. So they are long-term assets. People need to not just, I guess, focus too much on where the market is, because markets will have their cycles. The things that people should be looking at, you know, are the demographics. So, you know, what sort of people are living in those towns, not just now, but likely to be there in 10 years' time, what sort of infrastructure there will be, particularly where people are looking away from the city now. So we saw, a good example of that was Perth. We saw a lot of people going there for work, whereas now that's come right off since the mining boom collapsed. But, you know, maybe trying to look ahead and trying to think of those sort of things. So what will be popular? You know, is tourism the next big thing for Australia? So maybe try and look to areas that attract a lot of tourism. But it's just don't just focus only on cycles. It is a long-term investment. Start looking, I guess, that 10-20 year time frame.
Just before we wrap up, regarding property, an email's just come in from Robert saying, read the value of your home for the pension. He says, I've got more than 5 acres and was advised about 5 years ago that only 5 acres of land and the home plus some shedding would be considered as the primary place of living, and the remainder would be assessed, much like having an investment property. Is this the case under the new rules?
Yes, that's not changing.
I think the question on the form is something around 2 hectares, which I assume is five acres.
Yeah.
So, you know, they ask, is your home on land more than that 2 hectares or 5 acres? And then they try to put a value on the portion that your home is sitting on. Because often
this was to protect farmers and stuff too, wasn't it?
Well, it's to make sure that you can't have, you know, your 50-hectare property and have it all exempt as your own home. Mm. And I'm pretty sure that they stipulate it's the area directly surrounding your home, so you can't pick that they're valuing, you know, the forest bit where you can't actually produce anything. You know, they will actually take the area directly around your home as your own home. And so if you've got farmland, for example, that could be quite valuable according to Centrelink, and they'll reduce your pension accordingly.
But the flip side is, I have a client who lives in a beautiful location, but her property is sitting on, you know, the only flat bit of land, and everything else she owns is basically a cliff and an escarpment, which doesn't have a lot of value. So I guess the majority of her property is, you know, deemed to be her principal place of residence.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's about it for this morning. Gee, that went quickly.
Yeah, busy. Very quickly. Busy.
Very busy again.
Thanks, Michael.
Next week, Carly, you're back, and Paul.
Paul will be back in.
So I'll make sure those microphones are locked down and unmovable. Thank you for coming in tonight, Philip.
You're welcome.
See you next week, Carly.
Thank you.
We'll have plenty more coming up after the news at one. Stay with us for the open line part of the program. 131873 is the number if you'd like to get involved.